Good evening. We have a quorum present with 30 supervisors in attendance. I'll call us to order and ask that we stand and participate in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Good evening. Happy New Year to everyone. Especially those of you I haven't seen yet since the start of 2012. First agenda item for me is to ask for your input into ideas for the WCA conference that will be here in La Crosse in the spring, well, later on in 2012. And see if you have any suggestions for program, breakout sessions, speakers. I've been asked to serve on the program committee for planning that conference and would appreciate any ideas that you have. You can either raise your hand if something comes to mind right now or be thinking about it. We do have a little bit of time, but that committee will be meeting, our first meeting will be in February, so I hope that you will think about that. Think about other conferences that you have been at as a county board supervisor, perhaps, or a town supervisor, and think of speakers that have been particularly good, informational topics that have been covered, and pass them on to me so that I can add them to the mix for the conference that we will be hosting later this year. Anybody have any ideas right now off the top of their head? Otherwise, I'll keep asking. Yep, Supervisor Cotter.
Listen. Since we have such good collaboration going on around here, it's something that could be offered, possibly.
So collaboration, mm-hmm. intergovernmental mm-hmm. collaboration, great. Any other ideas right now off the top of your heads? If not, just think about that, please, and forward any ideas to me that you might have. Speaking of conferences, are there any supervisor conference reports? It's a slow month in Lake Wobegon, I guess. Supervisor Burke.
This isn't exactly a conference report. It's more of a point of personal privilege, but just wanted to commend Mark Schultz, who was selected as the Tribune Person of the Year. He's a former employee with the County Extension. The County Extension agent happens to be in my supervisory district, but I thought that that was a great honor for him and deserving.
And you, thank you for mentioning that, Supervisor Burke. At the request of Supervisor Meyer, a letter of recognition is being sent to also acknowledge Mr. Schultz's work on the Harbor Commission. He served on other committees in his former life as an employee of the county and also as a citizen member of a number of county entities. So.
Right, and he currently heads the Lake Onalaska Protection and Rehabilitation.
Yep.
Rehabilitation District.
A well-deserved honor. Reminder that January 31st is the deadline for submitting expense reports to the clerk's office. If you haven't already done so, I know as the year ended, the calendar year ended, folks were doing an improved job of submitting those reports monthly and in a more timely basis, but January 31st is the deadline for all 2011 expenses, so please make sure that you get them into the clerk's office. Last call for supervisor conference reports. All right, Administrator O'Malley.
Yes, just before I read the proclamation, I'd also like to mention that Monday night, January 16th, the community will be doing the Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration at English Lutheran Church at 1509 King Street. And one of our own this year, Maureen Friedland, will be recognized by the Leadership Committee for the Martin Luther King Annual Leadership Award due to her community service in the areas of diversity and recognition. Maureen, if you don't know, has done a great deal in this community over many years, recognizing the need for acceptance and tolerance and working with people and celebrating differences. And it's very nice to be able to know that Maureen will be recognized that evening. It's, again, Monday night, January 16th. I do see a hand out there from...
Do you want to speak before we applaud or after?
Well, I just want to say that I don't need a letter sent to me. Thank you for the... But I think this is an event that elected officials should try to go to, because I think it does recognize and acknowledge the African-American community and their contributions, and their learn a little bit about them, and also recognize other civil rights and talk about equal rights and so forth. So sometimes elected officials come to this meeting, and I think if people could try, that would be great.
And congratulations to you, Supervisor Friedman.
Okay, next, I have a proclamation, January 2012, Highway Safety Transportation Month. Whereas staff works so diligently to build safe roads for the residents of La Crosse County and visitors to travel upon, and whereas maintenance such as snow plowing, salting, grading shoulders, mowing, repairing, sealing, sweeping, and paving roads, and many other duties that keep La Crosse County highways clean and safe, and whereas the safety of all traveling persons is ensured by the hardworking men and women of the Highway Department, now therefore be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of January 2012 as La Crosse County Highway Safety Month, and urges all residents to join and recognize the valuable contributions of persons dedicated to ensuring safe roads for La Crosse County residents and visitors.
That proclamation is moved by Supervisor Paff and seconded by Supervisor Wood. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That is approved unanimously.
Next, under my report, I have a couple items that our Human Services Director and staff will report on, so I just turn this over to Jason. Jason Witt.
How's this? Okay. First, I wanted to acknowledge some staff that are going to be presenting with me. Lori Graff, who is our economic support section manager and who has now become the regional manager for the Western Region of Economic Assistance, and whose staff have done just a remarkable job in a very short period of time, making sure we were up in operational last Tuesday. And also, Dean Rupert, our operations manager, who was heavily involved in the planning for this effort and was really the architect for our county interagency agreements that brought this to fruition and met the deadline. Well, we have January 3rd up on the overhead, and really because for many months now in Human Services, we've been really marking our calendars and counting down to that day. It was a really big day for us in several areas. The budget this year for 2012 presented some tremendous challenges for us, and we had over $1 million funding loss for our department. But thanks to your support, we were able to meet that challenge without decreases in service levels to our most vulnerable citizens. But meeting that challenge meant that we had to let go of the status quo and redesign some of our key operations. Tonight, we're going to be highlighting two of the operational changes, two of the areas of focus in economic support and with the juvenile detention facility. January 3rd marked the day where we ceased to be solely a La Crosse County operation with regards to income maintenance and became an operation with a regional focus. And on that day, we became the Western Region for Economic Assistance. In doing so, we stepped up to the plate, and in our region alone, we contributed $800,000 plus to filling the state budget shortfall. As we look at the first week of our now regional operation, we wanted to quickly provide an update and touch on five key things. First, what changed as of Tuesday? What is at stake with this change? How did we do with 1 week now under our belt? And then just provide some preliminary information for a resolution you'll be receiving and acting on January 19th, and also outlay some of our priorities for 2012. So first, in terms of what changed, I guess the biggest change on January 3rd, we operated with a new reality. and we've seen this before, but we started operating with 31% less state funding, a decrease in 16% of our line workers region-wide, and that doesn't even include a 44% decrease in clerical support to economic assistance operations, and supervisory positions overall in the region went down 20%. So we begin operating with that reduction, but also with a caseload increase of about 20%, because now the county and the various income maintenance regions have taken on the cases that were formerly processed at the state level under a contracted system that wasn't working very well. So we're back in the business of serving those cases with a 20% caseload increase. And in terms of what changed, again, really just there's two main things that changed in administration and operations and workflow. In terms of the administration, we are now operating under one state contract for the eight counties in our region. And La Crosse County holds that contract with the state as the administrative lead. We really have a unified operating budget. It's approximately a $4.8 million budget. And again, $800,000 less in state funding than we would have been operating under without the reductions. We have one telephone number, whether you're Pepin County or Buffalo County. If you're calling for economic assistance support, and I am, you call an 800 number that's listed there. And along with that, which makes our region a bit unique but stronger, is that we have a unified management structure. We have a single manager, Lori, for the entire region. And cross-county supervision, which means all of our supervisors are pretty much full-time in this effort, and they do supervise staff not only in their own county, which they're employed, but also in other counties. Along with that, administrative change was a change in operations and workflow, and the two main changes there is that we have two new regionally centralized units. So we have a call change center operating out of La Crosse. Now, we had a change center out of that we've been operating for over a year under state pilot funds. So if anybody in the region has an address change or income change, they call that change center. But now, under the expanded version of that, it's also a call change center, which means any sorts of inquiries and questions also goes to that regionally centralized unit. But what is brand new to that is the client registration unit. So someone calling up is going to submit an application for benefits, calls that number to be able to set up, if they wish, a face-to-face appointment in their county or whichever county is most convenient for them to be able to have their application processed. So those were really two brand new regionally centralized operations that went live last Tuesday. Then the other change was La Crosse County workers or Pepin County workers or now those RIA workers will be handling cases on a pooled basis and could be working on cases from any one of those counties in the partnership. So those were the main system changes that went live last Tuesday. So in terms of, again, what's at stake with this change, and just very quickly, when we look at the number of county IM recipients, whether it's Medicaid, elderly, blind, disabled, food share, or Badger Care, again, we're talking about 18,787 were our November totals. Again, 1/6 of our county population. There is a staggering $125 million of MA funds that flows into the county for those that La Crosse County determines eligible for MA. $4.6 million of our department budget is offset by MA dollars for those individuals who are eligible, which was why it was very important we took kept control of that door and were able to do timely eligibility processing. But then also pretty staggering, $13.7 million a year of cash flow to our local grocers from the food share benefits. And what we know, like in Milwaukee County, when they did a transition that did not go so well, it had a very real and immediate impact for some of those neighborhood grocers in Milwaukee County.
Jason, are you up for a question?
Sure.
Supervisor Geary.
On those 18,787 recipients, do you know approximately how many live in La Crosse, the city of La Crosse?
I'm not sure in terms of how many live in the city of La Crosse as opposed to the county.
I don't. No. We could get that for you, though.
Okay. So that's the impact and why it's so important to get those right, those eligibility determinations. So the road to eligibility really goes through La Crosse County Human Services and now RIA for those important benefits. So now, with 1 week under our belt, how did we do? And with that, just to put this in perspective, it's only been 10 months since we stood before you talking about how 26 positions faced elimination under the governor's budget and how local presence for IM eligibility determinations was being lost. It's been only 7 months since the Joint Finance Committee, instead of adopting the governor's plan, adopted the county alternative, which led the paved the road to regionalization. So that really, in that short 7 months, we have really handed off to our staff in the department have designed a whole new IM regional delivery system, have completed the staff restructuring, have developed and put into place key parts of what is a complex information technology infrastructure to make this work, have formulated and negotiated the underlying contracts, all with the complexities of working across eight different county jurisdictions. And really, we'd put this performance up against any private sector company that would take on this role. And we do know, based on 1 week of statistics, we're already doing a better job than the state vendor did with regards to the operation that was ran out of Madison. So really, I can't say enough about the hats off to Lori and her staff. The staff have just been marvelous at this. Your support for this and the support of our bargaining units all played a key role in bringing this together. So with regards to the statistics, again, what happened is December 30th, if anybody from any of those counties would call for either a question or wanted to file an application for IM, they would call and the phone would ring in their individual counties and they would answer that call. As of January 3rd, everything is funneling through La Crosse County, which is one day a tremendous volume. And it's starting on January 3rd, really created a perfect storm in the sense that you had individuals over the holidays and kind of waiting to take action on their cases until January 3rd. So really, when we flipped the switch on that go live date, we had an extraordinarily high call volume, really double what we would have on a normal day. So it was a really fast and baptism by fire adjustment to the new process.
Supervisor Sobranek.
Thank you. You made reference twice to telephone calls. What kind of figures are you talking about, just roughly? Numbers?
And actually, we'll be showing those actually with the next slide in terms of
these things will be revealed to you, Supervisor Sobranek, and the rest of us.
But in terms of how the call flow process works, an individual call that 800 number. There would be a menu of it's about three or four options. One of those they would press depending on if they were looking to claim new IM benefits or they had a current case in the system. Based on that queue, that call would either go to our call change center or our client registration unit. And we're able to really come before you with some not just anecdotes in terms of how we did, but some real statistics, because it is a real fast-paced, complex operation, and the computer software really lets us know on a real-time basis how we're doing. Just as an example, the Call Center Anywhere software we have has several different metrics, and if you take a look at our computer screen of our supervisor, they have in a real-time format data on their screen at any given time in terms of what's our current call load, our call flow, how fast are they being answered, and prompts of that nature. So really rolling that all up, we can have a look at our call metrics for the first week. And this is our call change center. So with this, you can see when starting on Tuesday, it was 588 calls got queued to the call change center, which was high when you compare it to the rest of the week. Again, it was that flood of calls during that first day. So if we take a look at the first week, about 3,400 calls, and you can see how that breaks down per day in that really heavy first day. And then we're able to see how many calls were answered. And that's over the week about 84%, which means if someone called and got the queue and decided to hang up for whatever reason, and it could have been because they were on hold too long or for whatever reason, that's the percentage of calls answered versus calls that came into the system. So for the call change center, our average speed over the week, and this would be some, the length of time it took to answer the call that someone was on hold, averaged about 2 to 3 minutes, which is not where we want it to be. When we were operating just the call change center prior to flipping this switch to being a regional entity, we were at about 90 seconds. So we'd like to get back down to that. But realizing the call volume and some of the talk about systems issues we had during this first day, we thought that was that was pretty good. And we'll see on Friday that went up a bit, and that's because of some issues we were having in the registration unit. Some staff were shifted from this unit to that unit to do some troubleshooting there, and that's what accounts for that. The average talk time, that means the average amount of time to answer the question and to handle that case was about 3 minutes overall during the week. And then we're able to track, well, what was the longest time any one individual was on hold for the week? And we did have an individual that would have been on hold 25 minutes. Now, much better than the 2 hours that they were on at the state system, but still, we don't want to see this on a regular basis, and that was adjusting to some of the first week's activities. But overall, in terms of the call change center, we were pretty happy with the way the first week went, considering. Again, room for improvement, but we're pretty happy with that. Then we go to the client registration unit, which was a brand new unit for us. Where if someone calls in, they do the preliminary screen, and then they're able to schedule an appointment with that individual to go over their application with someone either in our county, or, and they have the calendars and desktops of every other worker in all the other counties at their disposal there. So with regards to that, you can see we started out with about 373 calls, and that was down to about 305 by the end of the week. Our call answer rate was lower there for whatever reason, but we know this is a little lower than actual because the state has informed us just today there are some issues with the Friday statistics for that. For this, the average speed of answer was 11 minutes, which is not where we want it to be, but if you see the days, we started on Tuesday with about 7 minutes there. By Friday, we were back down to around 6, and that amounts to some of that shifting in staff resources we talked about to bring that down. Our average talk time there, as there are a couple of issues there. They're taking down information for a screening in terms of the application, but also some circumstances beyond our control dealing with a state system they're entering information into there. So a little longer on about 5 minutes, and then we had someone on hold from an hour there, which is not what we not want to happen on a regular basis. So when we look at the overall week here, there's improvement needed there. So we want to bring those call times down. But with that first week, there were a couple of circumstances we were dealing with. One, we had some significant disruptions and delays on our state computer system. Which means when we received a call, all the information is entered into a system called CARES Worker Web, and that went down a number of times, and also as you went from one screen to the next was very slow. So we weren't able to control that state deliverable and state system there, and some of those issues I believe are resolved now or at least better. But also we had a vacancy level in the unit. We have 4 positions in that unit. 2 are currently vacant. Are we trying to wrap up at staffing levels? So we handled that by shifting staff from one unit to the next, and some individuals, line staff, helped us out with that. And we really got much better on that during the week. And actually, what I'm happy to report today, as we look in, okay, we got a week experience. We knew what we needed to fix with that. Our statistics already from today is a call answer rate of 73%, and the average time in terms of to answer a call being 3 minutes. So we're down significantly just in terms of learning and fixing things from just that one week. So in terms of metrics, that's where we are. And we're really happy we have a system to tell us how we're doing and hold ourselves accountable for that. But understanding at the end of each one of these metrics is a disabled individual, an elderly individual, that is really dependent on processing their application timely, and we're not losing sight in terms of who's on the other end of these statistics and the calls for this. So couldn't give an update without really giving kudos to our information technology department. The amount that they contributed to this project is tremendous. When you change that amount of calls that's coming in here, there's special equipment that has to be put on to handle that volume. They are our software support liaison for the state with our call center software. They worked continuously throughout the week, bouncing back down and forth. We're a big presence, troubleshooting the state system issues. And really, the state has looked to our IT department as some of the expertise on this call center software since we have the experience with it. Also serving as a help desk for seven of our other partner counties. And the multi-county interconnectivity, being able to have everybody's calendar on a desktop to do the teleconferencing for the joint supervision, allowing the shared documents and the shared policy manuals and those updates, and the time tracking software that each staff person now tracks exactly what they're doing at what given time so we can get the appropriate state reimbursement from that. So all of that was because we have really an A-plus IT infrastructure here, and it makes us a player in the game in terms of being able to continue to deliver a high quality of services here. So in terms of there will be a resolution for your consideration on January 19th, and that involves a supervisory position. We are not adding any supervisory positions in terms of the six that we had in our budget. Again, we're under a unified budget. What we knew going into this is that we didn't necessarily have supervisors employed and aligned in the counties where we may have been optimal, but we worked with where those supervisors were at the time. But we happened to have a vacancy in Jackson County with a supervisory position sooner than we would have anticipated. And really the needs of that position, there is not much of a need directly in Jackson County, but in supervision with Monroe County. But I guess the biggest need, what I think Lori would say would be the biggest need, to get supervisory support for our brand new centralized units here in finding someone with the right skill set and get that on board. So that's a position where location really makes sense in La Crosse, and with no implication again on the tax levy because it's all one budget now, and that it represents the really the best allocation of supervisory resources. We'll be asking you to create that position here, already budgeted for within the consortium budget. It just represents a shift there. So that will be the resolution on the 19th. And as we look ahead for priorities for 2012, we're looking at really three areas. We want to maintain the same level of customer service that we had going into this effort. So doing things like making sure we have a good call times, we have good follow-up with regards to cases, we're able to maintain timeliness and accuracy is a number one priority for us. But also, we want to pursue more equitable state funding distribution for 2013. We really have put together a model that's very highly regarded throughout the state in terms of its efficiencies. But in moving to that model, we're, I guess, bearing the lion's share brunt of some of the overall funding decreases in this area. Other consortiums of regions are not seeing funding decreases like we saw, and we're looking for to have that flattened out a bit for 2013. And to really have the stake, if we have one of the premier models, which the state's saying, then there's really a stake we all have on continuing that model and making sure we have the funds to do it. Tax levy in this is frozen. And number three is pursuing consistency with the Department of Children and Families with regards to child care eligibility. One of the unique things we did as a consortium, we really are a step ahead in terms of just not doing the traditional IM programs in a shared staffed model, but also adding child care eligibility to this model. We're able to use that funding more wisely, being able to do that. And it's really the same staff that historically have done that same function, so it's a really good fit then to bring that forward into the consortium. But the issue is that is governed by the Department of Children and Family instead of the Department of Health Services, and they're a little bit on different pages with regards to regionalization and what you can do across borders. For example, for IM, if someone's on the border of Monroe and La Crosse and it just is an easier drive for them to come to La Crosse, they can do that, but that's not the case for child care. And also, as we're working under a pooled caseload model for IM, we have certain barriers to that with DCF, and that's going to be an issue for us because some of our funding to this is tied to be able to use the child care eligibility dollars. The good news on this, which is just a couple of weeks old, is that we're meeting with the program head from DCF that has offered to meet with our region to discuss the possibility of a pilot program where we would be able to do some of these changes ahead of some of the other regions to see how they work. So we're really happy that they're meeting with us, and we may have the possibility to do that. But here again, there is a lot at stake because I think going forward in not only IM but a lot of areas of human services, we as a county are going to have a choice whether we're going to pay either way. They're going to take our county tax levy and have us contribute, but we're going to have the choice of do we want to package that money and send it away to maybe the state or another region to do our services for us. Often not as efficiently, and we lose a lot of local choice and control over it. Are we going to be a player in the area of regionalization and step forward, which we know will be good for the tax levy and good for our clients? What we've done so far really makes us a player. The fact that we've invested in a very good IT infrastructure makes us a player, and all of your early support and continued support for this project has made her a player for that, which bodes well as we adjust to what's the new reality of human services. So, again, thank you so much for your support of this regional initiatives, and would be happy to take questions on ES. Otherwise, we're going to segue into our next discussion of change with the juvenile detention facility.
Supervisor Spiker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I always worry when we go regionally what we get for the local county. Our IIM department was highly thought of and one of the better departments in the state. Are we shortchanging our customer, our clients in La Crosse County then? But you show times different. When they used to call just La Crosse County, did you have much faster service than they do now? Has it slowed it down because of regionalization?
I feel like the improvement we've made over just 3 days is phenomenal. I mean, for our client registration unit, today up to 73% of the phone calls answered, and their average speed of answer was 3 minutes for answering calls, and that was calls for all counties in our consortium. So that's getting close. Within 4 days, it's getting close to back where we were. I think that we're going to do a better job, and I think that we have a pool of talent in supervisors out in the field and workers who have been doing the work in specialized areas for 25 years, and now we can actually leverage that across the whole 8 counties instead of depending on our own staff. And then when there's someone gone, we can actually depend on somebody in another consortium to step in and fill in for us, and that's been one of our problems in the past. And what you're seeing on these reports, I have to stress the system problems that we had this last week with the computers, with the state, because they've done a lot of work in order to prepare for the consortium in our computer system. And one of those is allowing us to do a telephonic signature. So we don't have to send out a piece of paper and have somebody sign their name and wait until we get it back to give them benefits. The flip side of that is it's taking my client registration staff 10 minutes to go through a client registration and get a signature. They have to read something that takes 10 minutes. Well, that's 10 minutes of the call. It's slowing them down. So what we're doing is we're stepping away from doing that and doing it the way we always have, because the way we always have has worked. So some of those things that they think were going to help us aren't. And so we're learning that, and I think that in our last report from today, it shows that we're going to get closer to where we were for services for our entire consortium, and where we'll be at for La Crosse County, too.
Supervisor Mettinger.
Just A couple questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. Where is this call center located?
They're right next door in the Health and Human Services building. They're pretty much right next to each other. We believe in having co-located staff. Some of the other consortiums in the state have them spread out, so they have different workers in different counties. We believe that they need to be co-located so that they can bounce things off each other and really build on each other's skills.
Okay.
So, yeah, they're right next to each other.
One chart indicated that about a third of the calls weren't answered at all. One, how do you know that? And then do they think they call back, or they get frustrated and forget about it, or what?
Well, my assumption is they do call back.
I know it's early, and I'm not complaining mm-hmm. or anything, but mm-hmm. I just noted that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we were seeing is a lot of transfers back and forth from our client registration unit to our change center. And so one of the things that we did is we took staff in both of those and put them in. They have dual roles now. They can answer calls in both. So if somebody called the client registration unit and they waited and didn't get what they wanted, we're thinking that now closer to today, they're actually hanging on and being transferred to the right section.
And then are your callers, are they, some of these probably are people we've had for a long time, but are they trained to be sensitive to the needs of the clients? I mean, are they fully trained? I mean, you're dealing mm-hmm. with people, poor people, maybe some of them have mm-hmm. limited abilities or the first time they've contacted the system mm-hmm. or?
Over half of the staff in our call change center have been there since 2003.
Well, that isn't the question I asked, though.
So they've all gone
to be sensitive to the
yes.
needs of the poor.
Yes, they've all come from being ongoing workers. So they have actually worked with elderly, blind, disabled individuals. We put two staff in there specifically because they have an extensive background and are a couple of our better staff in dealing with the elderly and disabled. It was kind of a hard choice taking okay. them out of the ongoing pool, but we felt like that was really needed in our change center. So I think they do have those skills, and we will have ongoing training too.
Okay. But one question for Jason. This is my last question, Madam Chair. You use the phrase new reality. Does that mean that we've given up on the war on poverty? We're just going to have an attack on the war on the poor now? Or what is that, the new reality in this country? I mean, poor number of the poor are going up. You know, we're picking on the poor. We don't like the poor. We don't like entitlement programs anymore. Yeah. Is that the new reality, or what is it?
Well, I think we have two approaches to that. And one is as individuals, managers, and staff that deal every day with what we see as clients for need, is to be strong advocates for those clients and try to be a voice to our state government, our federal government, in terms of what is needed there and what's the reality and needs there. The other reality is administering programs the best that we can with the resources that we have today, which we don't have a lot of control over. So it's that reality of today. It's that reality of January 1st, January 3rd talked about as far as the new reality. And I just do want to respond also. It was a good question Supervisor Spiker had with regards to what we're getting out of regionalization and the impact on clients and our staff. I think it's a win-win for all the counties that are involved by the fact if we look at the number of cases our staff have been asked to handle over the years, what maybe started at a caseload of 300 per worker rose to 400 per worker, 500, and as we go into this consortium.
900 cases our staff had a couple months ago.
Yeah. And that compares to some of the other counties throughout the region who, as we went into this, were dealing with caseloads of 300. Certainly, full capacity wasn't being utilized throughout the region. And when you have that many cases, you're just not very timely when someone calls and leaves a message on your machine and your phone's ringing the whole time. What we're able to do by pooling resources like this is have the specialization in the call center to make sure, you know, those individuals maybe had to wait 3 minutes. But the alternative to that would have been to leave a message on a worker's answering machine that may have been in an application review for a client that maybe not have returned that call for 2 hours, and maybe when they did call, that individual wouldn't have been there. So in a sense, it utilizes the full capacity and allows for that kind of specialization. And we had a little bit of a lunch for the workers on Friday, and some of the workers, they said, gosh, the biggest thing is it's so quiet. There's no phones ringing. I can actually do my work because it's not constantly ringing off the hook with these 700 cases. So it really frees up staff time when you pool together resources regionally to be able to handle those higher caseloads. There's only so much we can ask from our staff before. We just got to redesign this and do this so it's realistic.
We actually did work with advocates on this. And we're told, you know, the main thing that they want is to get their benefits timely and accurately. And that wasn't being done in some of the areas. And it was becoming very, very difficult for us to do that in La Crosse with the rising caseloads and the reduced funding. I mean, we would have loved being able to stay in the model that we were, where they were case managers and everybody came in and you had a really good relationship with them. But we don't have that choice anymore.
We have several other supervisors who have questions. Supervisor Feehan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think back to when we first learned about this and what we were facing, which was the elimination of all the jobs in our income maintenance department and people in this part of the state being forced to make a phone call to a company in Madison, a private company that didn't have people that had the years of experience that people in our income maintenance department have. And this was a bipartisan effort in our state government. It passed 16-0 in the Joint Finance Committee. A lot of different people in our Board of Health were part of that lobbying effort. And I just want to commend you, Jason, and your staff for the incredible job that you've done to make this a reality. And I think that the technology improvements that you've made, and, you know, let's give this a chance. You've been in business for 1 week. I'm sure that people are going to become a lot more proficient as time goes on. But I just want to say thank you to all of you for the hard work that I know you put in to make this happen. I think it's a tremendous success story.
Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Feehan. Supervisor Cotter.
Thank you. This truly is something really exciting, and congratulations to all of you for what you've done here. What is running through my mind as I'm hearing how you're talking about spreading the load and all of that, is that likely also to lessen the load for La Crosse County, perhaps, due to people getting better service in the out counties that they maybe are not so encouraged to move into La Crosse?
That's definitely true. When we started our regional change center, the first day that we actually, before we even started operating, we had calls from the outlying counties wanting to know when we were going to start providing services, because they really, really wanted to work with our regional change center. So I think it's going to be a really good benefit for them. And it's going to help La Crosse County workers by reducing their caseload, like Jason said. Because there was a huge discrepancy between the number of cases in La Crosse versus, you know, those counties like Buffalo County and Pepin County. They had a minimum allocation, so they had a minimum number of staff, but their caseloads were a third of what we had. So it's going to allow them to help us do process applications, particularly mail-ins. We're not talking about the face-to-face, because we're still going to provide that, because we think that's really important. But to help us with the mail-ins and access applications where people aren't wanting to see somebody face-to-face, it's going to be a huge help.
Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think the stats you gave us on the 1 week aren't as helpful. I would love to see you give us a week 4, a week 8, and a week 12, and I think you're going to mm-hmm. see your efficiency and you'll get a leveling off. I've ran a call center and realize when you go to new software or whatever, it gets real difficult. And I think you'll be just thrilled when you see the improvement. And again, I don't think you're giving yourself a fair break in trying to do it in a week.
Mm-hmm.
So,
really,
and I thank you too for what you've done.
We're really looking forward to having the supervisor, because the intent of the supervisor is to be that hands-on person that watches these numbers, because we have a dashboard where you can watch these numbers at all times. So if you get busy, you got these alerts out there saying, everybody pick up 3 calls. And right now, it's a struggle between the supervisors that we have to do that and do the other pieces of implementation.
Supervisor Billings.
Thank you. Would you compare this to, would it be fair to compare this to maybe Badger Care core enrollment, where there was a, throughout the state, there were areas that were using the software, and so I know there were issues at that point of getting people enrolled and the software not performing. Is that a fair comparison, or you wouldn't do that?
The Badger Care core biggest problem was staffing.
Okay.
They had frontline staff that would answer calls that really knew nothing. They went through about a week training, and they're the people that everybody got on the phone, and they would take the information, but they couldn't do anything with it. And they had a dozen people that were actually at the level of my staff that would have to look at every single case to be able to review it and actually issue benefits. I think that was the biggest downfall for them.
And that was in Madison, right?
Right. But, I mean, yeah, I think that there's a big difference.
So the problems that you talked about, the problems waiting for screens to change and things like that with software, do you think it was a high-volume time for other regions too, mm-hmm. I assume? So you expect that to go away?
Right. It already has gone down some. And, in fact, it was the first day that we operated, every consortium in the state saw record numbers and phone calls. We broke Dane County's all-time record for phone calls on our first day. I mean, of course, theirs were a lot higher that day, but to say that we even broke their record before that was a lot for us. So I think the numbers are going to go down. In fact, I think that they're evening out.
Okay. And so I thank you for your disclosure. I mean, some people wouldn't give these figures to their boards because for a lot of reasons, it doesn't reflect what is business as usual. So, but I appreciate that you gave us a heads up on the first week and what was happening there with the number of calls and trying to deal with them. And so I'm happy that things are already turning around and will get better.
And the state is aware of it. We have three checkpoint meetings a day. We have two of them on our Call Center Anywhere software, which they just developed. So it tracks all of our metrics like he showed you. So we have two meetings a day on that. And now we have a meeting once a day for an hour that talks about CARES Worker Web, which is that system I'm talking about that has been really at a crawl, like 5 minutes to get from one screen to the next. So we have daily meetings now with the state on those issues.
And then my final question is about the problem of our region not getting the fair shake that most other regions got. And I know you're going to be lobbying in the Capitol with the Human Services Day in the Capitol, and the Wisconsin Counties Association is doing their day in the Capitol. What would help you to even this out? What do you suggest supervisors here could talk about with people in Madison? Because, you know, I'm sympathetic to Supervisor Menninger's concerns about you trying to manipulate things so it's a new world or a new reality, but it is a reality that you face, and in a lot of ways it's our job to be advocating to make sure that our Human Services Department gets what they need to do a good job for the people in our county. So what would you need from the board?
Okay, I would think, first of all, in talking to those in the state legislature, just in awareness that the way this actually shook out funding-wise wasn't what they likely expected with that. I think the idea was that the counties can do this more efficiently, but it was an intent to create IM systems that were so unequally funded across the state that all regions would be really sharing in the loss. So the first point is just in awareness that wasn't what actually happened. Certain regions got a much more heavy hit of the funding reduction than other regions. Because of that, what you'll be seeing is IM systems that could be look very differently across the state, and that wasn't an intent. But what we'd like to see overall, which we think is fair, is equitable funding by region that takes into account all the total amount of funding that's available in that region for income maintenance. In the formula that was adopted, what they really did is just take the total amount of funding and reversed a funding allocation that had been in place for over a decade, and instead said we're just going to divide it based on caseload, which sounds fair, but everybody's levy is frozen. So for regions like La Crosse, and especially the northern region, we weren't hit the worst. The northern region was hit the worst, where they've had a large IM allocation, and as a result haven't had a lot of tax levy within the program. That they got hit with a tremendous loss and weren't able to replace that with tax levy. So what you really need to do is take a look at a formula that takes into account what tax levy is available, what state federal funds are available, so it is real equalized from one region to the next. That's not the system we have right now, but I don't think that's what was intended.
We have another interesting topic for Jason staff and innovation. I'm saying that by way of encouraging just another question or two. From Supervisor Wood.
Thank you. Not a question, but I just don't want this opportunity to go by without really acknowledging what good government is like. I think this reflects our hiring process, that we get very good employees who are dedicated to our county. They have a willingness to meet challenges very optimistically. Because I'm on the Health and Human Services Board, I have seen the growth and development of this, but always the consumer and the taxpayer have been part of the guiding principles and also the element of choice. So in doing that and working with multiple counties, multiple territorial issues that might come up, multiple work styles, this really has been a wonderful thing to see happen, and I don't think we can thank the employees and realize the amount of work and the leadership that was shown in developing this. And I have nothing but admiration for the process and the people involved and the leadership involved. And on behalf of the whole board, I just want to really thank you for excellent, excellent work. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Wood. Supervisor Hampson.
What she said.
Okay. And with that, we will thank Lori and Dean. And Jason, you're sticking around for
for introductions here. Just before we leave the topic, a couple of things I want to make sure that if you come into contact with county board supervisors from our other partner counties, be sure to thank them also for our partnership. We couldn't have pulled this together if it was an equal. It was a team effort. We have forward-thinking directors in the other counties that brought this to fruition, so please thank them. And also, if you have contact with officials from the Department of Health Services, in some areas we may complain about the state, but on this project, and the officials we work with from DHS has been extremely supportive and helpful to us, very supportive of our model, and have provided us with a lot of assistance. So we've worked very well with DHS, and thank them for that as well. And then the next topic is we spoke about last March when we really got going on the income maintenance. The juvenile detention facility changes is something that you all were really forward thinking on in terms of providing approval for the department to move forward with some changes in June, looking down the road in terms of how that would impact 2012. But before the budget process began, you approved some of the staffing reconfigurations at the detention facility that took place as of October that allowed us to get some time with that new staffing structure under our belt. before we launched what we hoped would be the real change maker and the real difference maker, which was new programming at the facility. Since that time, the staff that will be presenting have been working extremely hard in developing a program that I think you'll agree is incredible, keeps us on really the cutting edge of service, and just a lot of good work on that. And to present this portion, I want to introduce David Steinberg, who is our superintendent of our detention facility. But I'm also very happy to announce Mandy Bissick is our new juvenile justice supervisor. That position was vacant for some time as we searched for the right candidate, because we know there's going to be a lot of important changes in the youth area this coming year. And we're very happy Mandy stepped forward and is taking on this role. And we'll turn it over to them.
Okay, to reiterate a little bit of what Jason said, we came in front of you last year in 2011 and to talk about our right-sizing project. And the right-sizing project included staff reductions, a substantial remodel of JDF to go with those staff reductions, and then implementing programming, treatment program, to keep our residents local in our facility. Like Jason said, we started in October with our staff reductions and have been running for 3 months that way. Our remodel is about 90% done. We just have a little finishing up to do on that. And we're here today to talk about our treatment program that we're going to unravel for you. Also, I really wanted to say something. We really worked hard with our legislators. This treatment program model that we're coming up with wouldn't be really feasible without our legislators pushing through some good legislation to Chapter 938 to allow us to hold children a little bit longer in juvenile detention than we had previously before. So today we're here to talk about CORE Academy, which CORE stands for a Community Option for Reengagement. The name took us, I don't know how long to come up with. There's so many names out there and whatever, but we really thought long and hard. And we think the CORE Academy really says what we're about and what we do and what we're going to do with our La Crosse County youth. Our mission statement: CORE Academy offers a demanding, carefully crafted, multi-layered treatment experience designed to challenge troubled youth and support their families to help them make lasting behavioral changes and prepare them for successful transitions back to the community. And that's basically what our program is based on, is community interaction and not sending our children away to other communities to learn the tools to make productive lives. Our purpose is to provide tools to teach youth to be productive members of their own community within their own community. Again, the whole flavor of this program is going to be community interaction. Utilizing evidence-based programming to reduce recidivism and target most serious offenders. We're going to be fiscally responsible, utilizing existing staff and facility, and adding programming, psychoeducation, and therapy, and reducing expensive out-of-county placements in residential facilities. And we're going to keep youth and their families involved and engaged in the case planning and case progress.
So who is a candidate for CORE Academy? First, they must be an adjudicated delinquent and ordered into this placement by the courts. They also must have had past intervention options that have proven to be unsuccessful through services and other potential placements. They have to have behavior is such that it warrants a secure setting. They must have a moderate to high or high risk level on the LSI, the Level of Service Inventory Risk Needs Assessment. They also need to be screened by a CANS assessment tool, a Child and Adolescent Needs and Strengths Assessment, which shows the need for an out-of-home placement. And all potential candidates must also be presented to the supervisory consultation and review team. It should also be noted that we decided that a screening process of this nature is necessary, as 8 of the 15 beds in the juvenile detention facility will be utilized for this program. So we want the right candidates to be taking up those beds. So, a description of our program. A CORE Academy is a court-ordered program for 10 to 17-year-olds used as a placement option. Please note that we hope not to put a lot of 10-year-olds in this program. The maximum stay allowed is up to 180 days, and the program is divided into four phases: the orientation phase, the skill building phase, community transition, and then aftercare. And we'll talk in more detail about each of those phases. The duties of the Core Academy social worker. We will be utilizing one of the current juvenile justice social workers. Half of their time will be spent doing duties of this program, the other half doing case management. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, missed one. Sorry about that. It's also a family-based therapeutic treatment program that includes individual and family counseling. We want to note that the parental involvement is a key component in this program, and that parents are expected to be active participants in their child's program. This will also be added to the court order that parents be involved. The psychoeducational groups to address drug and alcohol issues, criminal thinking, victim impact, independent living skills, and numerous other subjects. And then that youth will be enrolled in a full day of school through the La Crosse School District. Now going on to the social worker. Like I said, half of our current JJ1 staff will be utilized for this program. They will do a number of duties, including coordinate treatment plans with the youth's current juvenile justice social worker and other treatment providers within the community and within the program. They'll coordinate services with the youth, family, and local providers. They'll monitor progress in the program closely. As it's only a 6-month program, we need to ensure that the treatment plan is moving forward and progressing. And they will facilitate regular meetings and review development of case plans and completion of the program. Program benefits. There's a number of benefits that we feel this program will provide for La Crosse County youth. First, that it provides youth an opportunity to remain in La Crosse County, connected to community and their family. It also provides tools to make better choices and gives the youth the opportunities to learn about themselves and their behavior. It provides youth the opportunity to think about and plan for a successful future. It provides them the opportunity to get caught up with credits from their own school, as they will have their work brought into them so that they don't get behind any further and can actually catch up. At some point, they will even be able to go out to their home school, and we can aid in that transition back to make sure it's a successful one. We'll also provide safety and stability in an environment where the family will be actively involved in treatment planning and case progress, and it provides a more intensive contact with their primary social worker in La Crosse County. And we'd like to, you know, just so that you're aware, the current settings that we are sending kids that may go into this program are up to 1 to 2 hours away, which become difficult for families through transportation to be active participants in their child's programming.
Okay, now we'll talk about the phases of this program, and here are the key components of that. In phase one, the orientation, this will be the time we complete all of the assessments on our youth. A case plan will be developed with tangible goals and objectives. We'll determine the level of education in their curriculum. We'll do a baseline drug test with the detained youth, scheduling of family visitation and therapy, and orientation to the facility routine. And we, depending on how our residents work the program, this could last up to about 10 days. Phase two is the skill building phase, and here they will have weekly reviews of case plans, weekly group, individual, and family therapy. This includes AODA, the CARI guides, which is guides to criminogenic needs, and a therapeutic approach based on a co-occurring disorders program, full-time education, and regular judicial reviews. When we presented this to the judges, they really were sort of excited about this program and really wanted to become involved. And so we foresee monthly reviews by the judges to allow them to track the progress of our residents. Phase three is the community transition. Right now, we'll be looking at employment assessment, and we will be going across units to utilize our Chemical Health and Justice Sanctions Unit to utilize their workforce development specialist. They can earn day passes, coordination, which can include but is not limited to. They can earn the right to go out to school, go to the job center to look for jobs, community service, home visits, and other opportunities to go out into the community for therapy. And then we will begin our planning for phase four, which is aftercare. Phase four, which is aftercare, this is after our resident has left this program. They're still in there, but we need to be able to track their progress and make sure that they don't end up coming back into our program. So aftercare is a very big part of this, and we will work with the family on continuation of individual and family therapy as needed, and the primary social worker will resume responsibility of the case and provide wraparound services if necessary. Again, with this is we may also offer services to family members to ensure a stable environment when this child returns into the home.
The staff that we'll be utilizing for Core Academy will be our juvenile detention facility line staff. We're already provided for the day-to-day supervision and routine of the needs of the youth. Like I mentioned earlier, a social worker who is a county staff person will also be there to provide case management, group work, and other coordination of services. There will be therapists through Hiawatha Valley Mental Health, which will be contracted staff to provide psychoeducation, individual and family counseling, and AODA services. And there will also be a nurse who currently is contracted through the juvenile detention facility to provide physicals and medication maintenance for the youth. So, why Core Academy? It's a local option for our high-end juveniles that didn't exist before in the La Crosse community. It provides evidence-based, cutting-edge interventions that we believe will be a model in providing additional services for our youth. And we expect to see better results than we have been seeing with corrections or other out-of-county residential placements, and that's some data that we will be measuring in the future.
And in closing, we have established a program that we believe will benefit La Crosse County youth within their home community. We believe this will be an evolving program which changes to meet the needs of our youth we serve, and we are grateful for the opportunity to continue to deliver quality service to La Crosse County youth. Just also in closing, again, as in so many other things, I believe La Crosse County is on the cutting edge of this. We already have four different counties waiting to see what La Crosse County is doing with this 180 days so they can either, you know, copy that or do that with their kids. So, again, we are in the forefront of providing services to our youth. And also, again, I would be remiss if we didn't talk about quickly the committee members that have been working on this very hard for the last 4 months, which is Mandy and myself, Heather Wormer, who is a juvenile justice social worker, Heather Johnson, who is a juvenile justice social worker, Jill Dunn, who is a facility supervisor in the JDF and the RAC, Greg Mooney, who is a secure detention worker in our JDF, Jane Claycamp, of course, from Justice Sanctions, and Nancy Pullman, manager from Family and Children's Section. So they've all been working very hard on this. Questions or comments?
Supervisor Hampson.
I'm going to get the jump on everybody on this one.
Yeah, yes, you did.
This is something that the background to it is really stunning. It goes back to the inertia at the state. They knew they had, for years, they knew they had to close at least one state institution, and they could not make a decision. And they waffled and waffled, and we waited and waited and pushed and pushed. And so to overcome that state inertia just took an awful lot of energy on everybody's part. And I think it shows again not only the staff, but our board members, too, how willing we are to go to the mat. And again, people around the state are watching to see what happens. We're finally using evidence-based practices, which we've done with adults for so long, and we just have not made the step towards working with juveniles. And this is a huge, major step, and it's going to be so much better than sending kids off to state institutions. It's just a remarkable step forward, and it's, we just boldly go where no other county's gone before. And thank you very much for your service.
Will there be a TV series to follow? Supervisor Flood.
Thank you. First, I want to say this looks great, you guys. This looks like you did a really lot of work, and it looks good. I have a couple questions just out of curiosity. all potential candidates presented to the supervisory consultation. Oh, you know what I'm talking about here.
Yep.
Who is that going to be? Have you decided that yet? Who's on that?
It will be the current supervisors, so okay. The ongoing CPS supervisor initial assessment.
Okay,
myself,
that's what you
David,
meant by that.
And Nancy.
Okay, I'm wondering, when you're working with families, you're going to be doing that in all phases.
Mm-hmm.
So will you be bringing families into the institution, and will you be using conference rooms, or how you got it set up like that?
Yes, Bridget, you'll understand this best. Our control booth is no longer there,
yeah.
And that is going to be the family conference room there. Yes.
Okay. I think I need to come.
Yeah,
see
you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, and then have you chosen the academy social worker, or are you hiring somebody? Or
we currently have 3 vacancies in the juvenile justice unit right now, one of which was just filled, and 2 more to come from external bids.
Yeah.
We're hoping one of those 3 new candidates may be that social worker, but to get this up and running, like you saw, our goal date is February 1st. We're hoping to have an interim social worker that already exists and has been a part of the committee. So understands the root of what we're trying to get at.
Yeah, you got
program.
A whip for that? Do you?
Pardon me?
Do you have a whip for that, Mandy?
If you have one, I could borrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, I just think this is great. I think
it's
interesting, and I congratulate you.
Thank you.
Supervisor Mettinger.
Just a question on this court-ordered program.
Mm-hmm.
Like drug court, you know, that's an option. The individual drug court says, well, I can go in drug court or I can just take my lumps here. This is an order, not an option, right?
It is an order, yes. In lieu of an out-of-home placement or parole.
Mandy, will you use
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
I'm sorry. It is an order, yes. In lieu of a different out-of-home placement, perhaps out of county or a correctional placement.
Okay. And then just 2 questions on language. I'm always interested about words. Why did you use the word academy?
That's a good question. We did go back and forth on that one as well. We felt that because of the structure involved and the 6-month time limit, it will need to be a structured academy more so than a feel-good program. Although we have programming involved in this, we will be needing to move them along and ensuring their progress in a timely manner because we only have 180 days to work with them, some of which might be eaten up by the initial court process that they're going through in the beginning. So I guess when we balanced between academy and program, we felt it was more of an academy feel.
Okay, because I have a sister who teaches at the Challenge Academy at Fort McCoy, and that's the word has meaning, you know, and I just didn't know if you put a lot of thought into why you chose that word.
We did.
Because it's... says something. Then one final question. You talk about a challenged, designed to challenge troubled youth. Is there a difference between troubled youth and youth in trouble?
I think there is.
There is.
I think there is. Absolutely. I think this program will be for the troubled youth who have issues that need to be addressed and haven't been able to be addressed in other programming or services within the community and needs that intensity and that secure facility to ensure that that's being done.
So you can take that label, troubled youth, because kids in trouble, kids are always in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But you can take that label, troubled, and you're going to be able to apply it to every child in this academy.
I believe we are.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Because that's a key word, too.
Which is why we have the screening process that we do to ensure that the appropriate needs are there and the appropriate risks are there for them to be a good candidate for this program.
Okay.
Supervisor Doyle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I likewise want to commend you on both putting together a great program and explaining it in language that we can understand. I have a question for you on phase 3 where you talk about employment assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Is employment for a juvenile who is in school still a mandatory part of this program? In other words, is there a theory of keeping them busy as part of the whole program?
Each youth will be assessed according to their appropriate needs. Now, let's say we have a 13 or 14-year-old in this program. Employment might not be on the list of priorities for them. However, the skills involved with employment and surrounding what you need to become employed someday is a good skill that they could earn from this program. So each juvenile will be assessed based on their needs, and their case plans will be developed based on their individual needs as well. So if that is not necessarily a priority for them, we may focus that with other juveniles instead.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah,
we start new programs, and my question would be, how will we know if this is a success or failure, and how long will it take before you can make that determination?
All right, I'll take that one too. Well, the current talk right now amongst social workers is that there are several youth that they have in mind to put into the program. I think data that needs to be collected is, what would we have done with these youth if we didn't have this program? How much money would we have spent on those youth? And then collecting data to see how much recidivism we've had and how they've remained in the court system above and beyond. Time limits, as far as how, I would say within the first year, it's a 6-month program for each of these juveniles. I think to give them 6 months within the program and to see what they do with the 6 months after that program might give us a good idea of where we're going.
Yeah, and I guess in one of our things, because we look at some of our other programs, Ophelia House, and that is to get a, and this one I don't think would be the same, to get a, so we have apples and oranges, mm-hmm. or I should say, excuse me, apples and apples when we could right. look at recidivism.
Right.
And I hope that you'll be able to do that. And absolutely. I look forward to, I think this will be pretty neat. So thank you.
Thank you.
Supervisor Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like this program is really going to fit another need and help in that whole continuum of services. So I'm really impressed by the structure of the program and the fact that you're going to, a couple questions. Is the program, is the Core Academy going to be held entirely in the juvenile detention center?
Well, as you can see through the phases, phases 1 and 2 will strictly be within the juvenile detention facility. By phase 3, they will be earning their way outside into the community, but they'll sleep at night in the detention facility. So they'll be earning their way. We'll be monitoring them through GPS monitoring to ensure they're getting to the destinations that they say they're supposed to be going to and are scheduled to go to. And as they continue to earn that trust, they'll earn things like home visits, perhaps overnight visits with their family, to then get to phase 4, which is aftercare, where they've earned their way out of the program, and we're just monitoring them to ensure that they stay out of trouble.
Okay, thank you. And you didn't mention it in your presentation, but how many youth can you take at one time?
Eight. Yep, 8 of the 15 beds in the facility.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. And the other beds in the facility, the facility will still be utilized as a juvenile detention center then for certain situations and cases like it always has been?
Yes, 7 beds will be left for short-term juvenile detention as needed
okay.
By La Crosse County and okay. other counties that utilize our facility.
Okay. How has that been utilized recently, like in the past year, the 7 beds?
How many?
Yeah, like well, numbers of students.
In October, we downsized. That's October 1st is when we downsized to the 15 beds. And so we haven't been running the Core Academy yet, but we've been as high as 12 kids and we've been as low as 1, but we're averaging around 6
okay.
or so. It's going to be tight.
Sure. I guess my only concern is, for example, let's say there's an assault at one of the high schools, and let's say that there's an arrest made, and let's say that the student is found to be a danger to either the school or themselves. We have to make sure that we have a facility for these students who are arrested and who are pose a threat to the community.
And you're saying if we have 15 kids, what do we do with that 16th kid?
I just want to make sure because I know
we do have contingencies for that. We are still licensed for 26 beds.
Okay,
it's a policy that we have went down to 15 beds. We're
okay.
still licensed for 26.
Okay,
and so if something were to happen like that. We may be able to call on extra staff and still have
okay,
that.
Great. Thank you. That helps. Thank you.
Supervisor Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to commend you on this very innovative wraparound program that really takes all the factors into consideration that come together to create a troubled youth. You've thought about the AODA. You've thought about the mental health, the educational piece, the family and employment piece. This is really a multidisciplinary approach to dealing with troubled youth. And I think the brilliant part of it was that you combined a need with an opportunity. We had this facility that was half empty or considerably empty, and you came up with a program that was very much needed and made good use of that facility. So I want to commend you on that.
Supervisor Cotter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another very, very exciting program, and it is really, particularly the part of it that I like is the involvement of the parents all the way along the line, because basically you're going to be training the parents too. And but what happens to youth who otherwise could be good kids that could fit the program, whose families are not so ready to provide that supportive situation?
I think that becomes a part of the screening process. You know, we want the youth who go through this to have a chance at success. Like David mentioned in one of his slides as well, we also, while the youth are in the program, we're also going to be looking at identifying the issues within the family, so that when we're transitioning the youth back into the home setting, that family environment is a safe and stable one as well. We know too often that the youth that we work with, it's not just the youth's problems, and sometimes it comes from the family as well. So that's why, by bringing a program here into our community, we're able to serve those families as well. So I think to answer your question, you know, that again has to be screened on an individual basis. We do have the court's backing with this program. So as I stated, the family will be ordered into this program as well to be active participants in it. We're also hoping and going to present to the judges hopefully in the next month or so about this program, that the judges will have an understanding and do a monthly review of each of the cases so that we can report in on not how only how the youth is doing, but also how the family is doing in their portion of the court order too.
Well, that's wonderful. So perhaps the next step then, when you get this up and running really well, you'll start looking at the kids who really need family support that aren't getting it.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Supervisor Friedland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask about 17-year-olds and how that fits into this. If a 17-year-old were to commit a crime for the first time, it's my understanding that they would go to adult court. So how would they fit into this program? And if they start their criminogenic ways a little bit earlier than that, and they're sort of just getting to 17 years old, how does that play in? Because I remember Jerry Huber, our former Human Services Director, talking about how there was a tendency to sort of give up on these older kids, or maybe I shouldn't put it that way, right, that the resources needed to work with them were so great that their needs tended to be put aside in favor of the younger kids where there was still hope.
Right.
So, you know, are you going to be like giving a priority to the younger kids rather than the older kids? How does this work? Because, you know, when these kids end up in jail where they don't belong, mm-hmm, that's where they really get set on a
right
path of meeting the wrong people and getting to where they're more likely to end up in jail again. Mm-hmm. So how's all that going to work, please?
Okay. So to answer some of these questions, first of all, we can continue to serve 17-year-olds. Let's say we have a youth who is on supervision at age 16. Their court order can run through their 17th birthday all the way up till their 18th birthday. If they committed a new crime, you are correct. They would go into the adult system if they're age 17. However, if they've been on supervision, let's say before the age of 17, and they continue to get in trouble by violating their court order, this could be a recommendation that we could take to the judge based on violations of their court order, their juvenile order. So we could technically have 17-year-olds in this program. Again, I think it goes down to individual assessment of each of these cases and appropriateness through the screening process. If this could be a last-ditch effort for some of these 17-year-olds before they hit the adult system.
Right. It's kind of hard to say whether you want to put your
right
efforts on the older kids so that they really don't spend too much time in jail, or whether you want to work with the younger kids so that they don't get to where they're 17 years old and jail's a possibility.
Right. And let me say that we put a lot of thought into that 10 to 17-year-old age range. Like I said in the presentation, we really hope that we're not serving 10-year-olds, because that, too, leads to a whole other set of issues with exposing 10-year-olds to 16 and potentially 17-year-olds who have been involved in the justice system. However, we also didn't want to take those age ranges out completely, because there could be that small circumstance where a 10-year-old may be appropriate or a 17-year-old may be appropriate. But again, the screening process is what it is to ensure that it's appropriate.
Is that it for you, Supervisor Friedland? Supervisor Paff.
Thank you. This is for La Crosse County only. This is not reaching out any further.
That
I
is
thought
correct.
You mentioned to start with that some of them were 1 to 2 hours from their home. That would be a little tough, wouldn't it, in La Crosse County?
Right. That's the way that we are currently running with the programs that we are sending juveniles to currently, such as Elmore Academy, Wyalusing Academy, Eau Claire Academy. As you notice, all academies that we're sending them to, 1 to 2 hours away. This brings them back into their home community.
Okay, well then when you start here now, February 1st, where will you get your first clients, so to speak, from? Or will you be bringing some of those back from those academies that are originally La Crosse County residents?
Don't say Farmington, Mandy. Whatever you
do. No. I wasn't planning on it.
Okay. Where are you getting your first ones to start when you're going to...
Our current caseloads are currently dictating some of our potential referrals into the program. We also have a few placements that are in, you know, Elmore Academy and some of the academies that I mentioned that, although we may not bring them back immediately because it wouldn't be good for their own case plans, we may utilize our program as a transition back home. So it's going to be a combination, I think, in the beginning of those who have current caseloads, of the current caseloads that we currently have, I should say, as well as who assessing who's currently in placement and could this be a better option for them.
Is that it for you, Supervisor Paff? Supervisor Billings.
Thank you. I think it's a great program. I think it's come, you've done really good work, come a long way in the last several years. I know it's been a process. I'm going to ask a question that I always ask when we make changes in the juvenile detention facility, and that is, how do we know we're not mixing populations that shouldn't be together, number one? And my understanding is that some of these juveniles that are sent to the other academies, their behavior is more egregious. I don't know if that's the technical term, but so if we are bringing them back here to save money, and it is a good program, but it will save money too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So how do we know we're not just creating a crime school for some of those kids that are here in our juvenile detention facility anyway? So mixing of populations and the crime school issue.
The only thing I guess I would say to that, and Mandy can talk to this also, is 99% of all of those kids were together in juvenile detention before they went to the academies also. They just weren't, you know, they were being housed there until their due process was done. Now they're going to be housed back together and getting programming to treat some of those problems that they have. So, I mean, if you understand what I mean, they were all there together anyway. That it's they'll be there a little bit longer, but we also have a plan that our core academy kids, for the most part, will remain separate from our general detention, short-term detention children.
And if I might add to that, as the program kids, as the core academy kids continue to go through this 180-day process, their attitudes and beliefs, hopefully the goal is for them to change as time goes by. They may actually become model inmates, for lack of a little better word, for some of the kids that are in there for the 72-hour holds and shorter-term detention stays.
And I have one more question. If a child has a family that's not the model family, mm-hmm. and most of these kids right. have families that aren't model families, right?
Right?
I mean, a lot of the kids, their families don't visit them now up in the juvenile detention
right.
facility. So it does that automatically keep a child out of the program?
No, absolutely not. That will, like I said, be a requirement of families. That will be something that we will continue to report back to the courts on. It will be an expectation that they have a regular, not only family counseling session, but family visitation schedule as well that the social worker will help to implement. So if it's the juvenile that's progressing forward, but the family that's keeping that juvenile from progressing, the court will be aware of that and actions will be taken as appropriate with that as well.
Okay, good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Supervisor Flood, did you have a second comment or question? Okay. Back to you, Dave.
I'm sorry. I have one more slide. This is sort of an adjunct, I guess. As we had our secure detention inspection conducted on November 2nd. And just to go along with this, we unrolled our plans and remodeled to the Department of Corrections and are very impressed with our operational changes. They feel our facility is very clean and orderly. The facility operates at an extremely exemplary level, and these are all lifted from our report, and hopefully you got a copy of that report. They said it could be used as a model for other detention facilities, and this report says an awful lot about our staff. And our staff in the detention center over the last 6 years has gone through a lot of changes, with downsizing and losing staff, and asked to really bear the brunt of a ton of change. And to get this kind of glowing report from our jail inspectors says a lot about the staff who work in the detention facility. So I just wanted to highlight that just a little bit. So thank you.
Thank you, Dave and Mandy, both. We are a clapping crowd tonight. Thank you. Back to you, Administrator O'Malley.
Okay, I have a couple of quick items. I'm going to quickly do the February meeting conflicts, as we call that up, and I'll come back to that. We didn't put a calendar of committee meetings on your agenda today because we're going to be meeting with a couple of committees that may need to move. Wisconsin County Legislative Conference is coming up in February. It's Tuesday, February 7th, and Wednesday, February 8th. For those of you that are interested in attending, we have registration forms. You can talk to Margaret in the County Board Chair's office. For
the deadline is the 17th. If
deadline
I
is, I was going to get to that.
I'm sorry, to
that's
Margaret.
Good, but that's a good reminder. The deadline is.
Can you tell she told me a few times today?
January 17th. What was that deadline, Madam Chair?
I think it was the
17th of January. So you
want to Margaret meet by the 17th of January.
And so it's a Tuesday and Wednesday. So what I'm going to suggest is that we not have a policy planning meeting for Monday, February 6th, and just do the regular committees that day, Aging, Long-Term Care, and Public Works, in case people are planning to go down early for that meeting. And then I will talk with the other committees, Judiciary and Law, Health and Human Services, and Executive on Wednesday to see if we need to move those meetings. I'm going to suggest that I not be attending Judiciary and Law and Health and Human Services so that you would not have to move your meeting, and that we possibly reschedule Executive to a little bit later on Wednesday. But I'll deal with those committees at that time. Unless there are significant numbers of members that are hoping to go, that we would lack a quorum for those meetings on Tuesday. So I'll just take a breath and see if people are concerned about that or if we should.
Any protest to the notion of not having a planning meeting on February 6th, the evening of February 6th? Okay, we got that one taken care of.
Okay, and if there are any movements happening to the other committee meetings, we'll talk about that tomorrow night, tomorrow afternoon. And then at exec, there's always a conflict on Wednesday of the legislative conference for myself. Execs and administrators get together with the lobbyists and talk about, and that's always Wednesday afternoon. So we'd either have to move exec to late in the day Wednesday. Some years we've moved it to Thursday, but I'll ask executive committee members that day after tomorrow. Is that okay? Okay, the next item that I have, and I won't go through every slide unless folks want me to. I know there were a couple of you that got a chance to attend the meeting the other evening last week that we had with community members. I'll just give you a genesis, and then I'll ask, you know, answer as many questions as I can. There was the idea that came out of our joint city-county housing task force, along with a number of ideas, to try to figure out ways to stimulate economic development and particularly residential development in the city of La Crosse. And one of those ideas that came up and has been explored further is the concept of targeting for some redevelopment of the north side of La Crosse. I'll orient you to the map in case you're not picking it up immediately. This is actually turned on its axis. The line that goes this way is actually the highway from. Does this have a laser? I wonder. Yeah. Oh wow. Okay. Cool. This area, of course, is I-90, and this area, of course, is 5335, cutting through the north side of La Crosse. This area being where Gary lives, and I'll pinpoint his. Oh, and excuse me, on Alaska right here, and then of course the north side of La Crosse, the shopping mall there, Walgreens. etc., along the north side of the river. And to orient this, it has been talked about for a number of years, the potential for redevelopment in that area with an aging mall and those types of things. And this brainstorm came out of the Joint City Housing Task Force, and unbeknownst to the person that brought it up at the committee, they asked myself and Ron Chamberlain to look into, well, what is the timing for Exit 3? When are they going to be dealing with that? And coincidentally, the discussion has been going on for some time. There is a project scheduled to begin for 2013 to redo that area, and I've actually got another map that I can show you that would change it into basically a diamond interchange. Also, during that whole process will be a resurfacing of major parts of I-90 and 35-53. About $56 million worth of state money will be invested in this whole area over the next 3 years, starting in 2013. So the question was asked, is there any opportunity to look at a realignment of Exit 3 that might shift Exit 3 towards the railroad tracks a little bit east, that might accommodate a realignment of 35 and 53 that could allow for greater access and development to the waterfront, perhaps a waterfront trail, perhaps a park, perhaps a residential and commercial development that overlooks the water and has better access than just the highway, which is there now. This is a very big idea. Whether or not it makes sense will be a debate that the community will have at a number of upcoming meetings. I know City of Onalaska will be debating the shared funding. City of La Crosse will be debating the shared funding. You will receive a resolution from Economic Development Fund and the Executive Committee that will weigh in on this, and the La Crosse Area Planning Committee will also weigh in on this. The concept is to do a study of what the cost would be of realigning the highway as I described, and I can also go to a couple of other slides on this. And whether or not it's feasible to do this and whether or not it generates enough new development over time to justify the cost of moving the alignment and the highway. So you'll receive a resolution that will come in your packet for debate on January 19th. If people want me to, I can go through the rest of the slides and show you some of the things that the DOT has done. Again, this is not on for your agenda for tonight for debate. Each of you, I know a number of you have been at some of the meetings on this and may have read a number of the articles on the newspaper. Again, the primary decision-making, of course, will be the City of La Crosse. If the next stage is, based on the results of the study, is to do the full environmental impact statement and to pursue this more long-term, but it's whether or not to take it that next step. The decision will be made whether or not to do the study yet this month in January. In the middle of March, the alternative will come back and be presented to the public, and then it will be really in the La Crosse City Council's purview to make some decisions about whether or not to pursue this longer term with the Department of Transportation. I do want to take a moment to just point out that the connections that Ron Chamberlain, our Highway Commissioner, has with Department of Transportation and their good work, Joe Olson and his staff, were very cooperative in trying to piece together what the scope of work would look like, what could actually come together quickly enough that it would, if the project is turned down, that we don't delay the redoing of Exit 3 as it exists for 2013. But if this is a viable option for our north side and for our community entrance to really both communities, that will accommodate bike ped better than we have now, will actually accommodate some of the safety concerns about the height of the overpass, as well as the potential for redevelopment, that they've really done a great job of pulling this together quickly. A whole lot of other details in other slides, but I don't know how much folks want me to walk through that. I just wanted to make sure you knew this is coming up, and we're going to have input from the La Crosse Area Planning Committee on whether or not they're willing to help with the share of funding, the City Council of La Crosse and City of Onalaska that will be weighing on this issue before, and you're actually the last elected body that will be debating this, but with prior input for consideration of shared funding. We're only asking the County of La Crosse for $5,000 of shared funding from our La Crosse Economic Development Fund budget, which is out of the line item for business and industry promotion. This certainly seems like a viable thing to help provide shared funding to our signature city, who is in need of some additional redevelopment, and at least so far has been positive about it. And I know there are council members here that will be weighing in on this issue at their own meeting, but I'll just take a breath and see if there are questions rather than go through all 12 slides.
So the
unless
the
you insist, I will go through. No, okay.
The we're happy you're taking a breath, and we will be happy to call on supervisors. So what we're asking tonight is questions, input. There is a resolution that will come to us on February 19th through executive committee.
January 19th.
Did I say February?
Yeah,
sorry. January 19th thanks. Through Economic Development Fund and on to executive committee. So that's the point of decision and voting on this study itself. First up is Supervisor Flood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're looking at that. You move the exit east. And is that blue section? Did you want the new road on the east end of that blue section?
That's the potential. That's part of what's going to be worked out with the public works staff of both department or both cities and their planning staff at the same time. So the result of the DOT study will be where would that road be able to be relocated, what's the cost of doing that. There's a lot of utilities in there as well. And then independent of the DOT study, our planning staff in working with the City of La Crosse planning staff would try to identify the sheer level of redevelopment and density of tax base that could be recovered by accommodating existing users and relocating existing users in the redevelopment, basically in that blue or purple area.
So how far back does that go? Does that wipe out Shopko? Does
it recognize that it's an aging
Shopko is in the blue.
It is in the blue. Okay. And so the idea could be that the highway could go behind that or through that. And again, that wouldn't be immediately. It would be part of the discussion and working with relocation. What you'll hear about malls that are of that age, generally malls go through a facelift every 10 to 20 years. This one has not had a significant facelift in the entire time since, I believe, did Larry say it was developed in
72.
Early 70s, 72?
1972.
And having been in Burnsville, for example, that mall went through several complete refurbishments during the time I was there, one major redo. In order to stay viable, malls have to go through restructure, and so that would also be part of the discussion, is talking to those business owners and seeing if that's anywhere on the viability. There's some question about it, the facility being in receivership and some other things that are challenged about its long-term viability and success. So that would start some of the discussion if that's the direction that the City of La Crosse wants to go with this new information.
Did that answer your question, Supervisor Flood?
Brings up a whole slew of other ones that I will learn about.
Certainly. The study basically will answer some questions. It won't answer all questions, but one of the things we experienced in the meeting last week with the public is there were more questions than we could answer, because that's part of the purpose of the study, is seeing what's viable, whether or not it's cost-effective, those types of things. And again, the number that I've utilized is for a $56 million project going on, to spend less than 0.1% to study what the viability is of making some changes is really, $50,000 sounds like a lot of money, but it's a very small amount when you're going to spend as a community, as a state, $56 million on overall redoing that. You want to make sure it's the right thing to do before you take that next step.
Supervisor Feehan. Supervisor Geary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In our packet, then, we'll have more detailed information other than the resolution, specifically on what happens in that blue area or what. Am I assuming most of the existing businesses in the blue would be torn down?
They might be accommodated in a redevelopment. They might actually be in a new structure.
Right.
That would be part of it. But no, the resolution is just to do the study and to answer some of those questions. How many businesses would be impacted? What relocations might happen. What's the cost of that relocation? What's the cost of relocating the highway? What's the best alignment for that? How many houses are impacted? How many businesses? So that then you can go that next step. Because right now you can't assume which businesses and which alignment makes the most sense physically from an infrastructure standpoint.
And then that Highway 35, is that basically the same then with just some improvements on it? Or
no, 35 and 53 could end up being relocated from its current alignment and actually allow for waterfront development, view, waterfront parks.
On the other side,
parks.
But that would have to move east then.
Correct. So the idea is that, if I can get this, is that currently obviously it goes right along the waterfront and there's nothing in between the highway and the water. If, for example, it could go behind or through where the existing mall is, it could open up all of that for a bike ped walkway, waterfront condominiums or housing that overlooks that area, businesses or restaurants that overlook the water in a way that some of our homes actually have access to now in the town of Campbell or Nokomis. I mean, there are other areas of development along this Black River that actually have that kind of access. Currently, none of that happens because the highway just takes up that area. Some people know
so the
what
resolution
I'm talking about.
Will be coming through next week's meeting.
Next week, right.
Anything else for you, Mr. O'Malley?
And I, just based on those questions, I will include this PowerPoint set of slides in the agenda packet with the resolution that might answer some other questions that were presented by the Department of Transportation.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Is that it for you, Mr. O'Malley? Dave Lang. Welcome to official front of the room. Now your corp counsel, Bill Shepard's gone. We're glad you're here. Take it away, Dave.
We were going to have something to report, but it's a little premature, so I'm not going to have anything to report at this meeting, but probably very soon. So nothing to report.
More things will be revealed to all of us. Thank you, Dave. Vicki Burke, Executive Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Item 1-2, right of to the honorable members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors regarding right of first refusal to acquire Schrader property on State Road 16. Whereas the Schrader property located at W5151 State Road 16, La Crosse, Wisconsin, is an irregular shaped parcel which contains 4.64 acres or 202,118 square feet that is located to the immediate north of county property operated by the La Crosse County Solid Waste Department, and whereas Resolution 81-211 was adopted by the County Board on February 17, 2011, authorizing the County Administrator to hire an appraiser to determine the fair market value of the property and for the matter to be referred back to the Public Works and Infrastructure Committee. Whereas prior to making a decision regarding the acquisition and development of the Schrader property, the county needs to engage in further planning and discussions with the City of La Crosse and the City of Onalaska regarding future economic development potential, and whereas the owners and now therefore be it resolved that the La Crosse County Board does hereby authorize the County Board Chair to sign a right of first refusal with the owners of the Schrader property in accordance with the terms specified above, including payment of good and valuable consideration in the amount of $10,000. Be it further resolved, the County Administrator and Finance Director are further authorized to make the necessary budget adjustments to carry out the intent of this resolution. Be it further resolved that any decision to exercise the right of first refusal and purchase the Schrader property shall be contingent upon the approval of the County Board at a future meeting. Fiscal note, the $10,000 will be paid out of land sales account number 100-31050. I move its approval and ask to retain the floor after the second to make a subsidiary motion.
Moved by Supervisor Burke, seconded by Supervisor Cruz. Back to you, Supervisor Burke.
Madam Chair, I move to postpone indefinitely the resolution.
Supervisor Burke has made the motion to postpone indefinitely, seconded by Supervisor Richmond. Discussion on the motion to postpone indefinitely.
Madam Chair, may I explain Absolutely. That the motion to postpone indefinitely, unlike the motion to table, still allows debate and still allows members to speak to the merits of the resolution.
Supervisor Ebert.
Yeah, I wonder if Mr. O'Malley would give us an explanation. I see we have a letter following this, and wonder if he'd be so kind as to enlighten us on that, please.
Certainly. Hopefully you've had a chance to read the memo. Based on the action of the board to hold this over for 60 days, we went ahead and took the board's suggestion and met with county our city staff from both City of Onalaska and City of La Crosse. And as you'll note in here, we had a pretty good discussion. I think there's quite a bit of interest in continuing to pursue potentials for development in this area. However, the agreement from those that were in attendance from City of La Crosse and City of Onalaska was that at this time it's probably premature to pursue a right of first refusal as we had negotiated, and that there are a number of other steps that it would be helpful to get into place. So first of all, City of Onalaska, the mayor, and Dina Murphy, the zoning administrator interim, I don't know her exact title, are going to work with their planning commission and their comprehensive plan process and the adjacent landowner to look at the concept of amending their comprehensive plan from residential to commercial industrial, and that they'll deal with that fundamental issue first to make sure that that's what their community would like to see. They were very excited about the idea and that that it has some potential, but that's the first step. They would need to go through their process. Secondly, it was suggested that instead of pursuing the right of first refusal with the Schrader property, that what we might end up doing is getting the agreement from the owner to do some test borings or some it's actually digging pits to actually determine the type of soil that's there, because for the property to be marketed and sold, it will need to be leveled off anyway. If there's a potential for the soil there to be used at the landfill, that we could then come back with a separate decision and purchase that, or if once we determine what the soil is, that maybe we could help facilitate another use for it. Perhaps it ends up being the road base for the eventual road that would go in there, or something else, because either way the property is going to have to be leveled. So we'll pursue that and verify what the quality of the soil is and what options we have there. The third item is that the county staff will continue to work with City of La Crosse to develop what infrastructure would be necessary, what the proper alignment needs to be, all the types of things that could end up happening there as far as utilities, and to look at what that alignment of that roadway eventually to extend for development could be for eventual development of the parcels that we had talked about, how that would be paid for, larger lots for development, and finally then to pull back the group together by the end of second quarter to actually see what we've accomplished on each one of these tasks and whether or not there was anything else that could happen as far as being ready for the market and development to expand development in that area. I want to remind you that the Schrader parcel, as well as both the parcels that county staff have talked about, are all existing within the City of La Crosse TIF district, so it is viable and important to talk about what the long-term development and extending utilities there. So we've taken the input from the board to heart, worked on the exact details that are necessary to actually take that next step, but at this time the right of first refusal is not recommended, and that you'll see these individual steps come back to each one of the governing bodies as we go along.
Thank you, Mr. Malley. I'd also like to commend the supervisors who put a halt, or at least slowed this down a little. Sometimes it seems that we get a little bit ahead of ourselves, and I think this was a good example. Frequently we can slow things down just a little and still make a better decision. Thank you.
Ready to vote on the motion? Oops, Supervisor Spiker.
Yes, I have a question. What we're voting on is postponed indefinitely. We're not, what Steve said in paragraphs 1 through 4, we haven't approved that, or do we have to approve that, or is this, have we authorized the administrator somehow to? You're talking two different issues.
No, we're talking about bringing closure on, at least letting Mrs. Schrader right. know that we're not going to exercise the right of first refusal. The other items that are there, I don't believe require county board action. They're to inform you on the items that are going on. Any further action
is telling what you're going to do then.
Right, unless you think that we shouldn't be doing this either and refer that back to committee. But it seemed to me that these were the kinds of questions you needed answers to before you would consider any further investment of dollars, and that these are questions that need to be resolved for development in that area.
Okay, thank you.
Supervisor Bills-Kemper.
Oh, thank you. My question was just answered. Thank you.
On the motion to refer indefinitely, I mean postpone indefinitely, sorry. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That motion is approved unanimously. Anything else for you, Supervisor Burke? Thank you. Suggestions for future agenda items. Supervisor Hampson.
This isn't. I just wondered if someone could stop the flow of crap from the Mormon Church. I'm not interested in the ravings of a convicted rapist, and I'd like it to stop.
It's federal mail. There's not much that we can do about it. The clerk's office has appropriately passed that along and put it into mailboxes because it has been sent through U.S. mail.
Marvelous.
Supervisor Mettinger.
Well, I just had a question similar to Sharon's, and I appreciate people that are always trying to save my miserable soul, and that's fine, you know. But I didn't see any postage on this, and there's no postage on it. How does it get in our boxes? Is it mailed in a how does it get?
We're just as curious as ourselves, but it comes through the mail. It comes through the mail room every day. They say it's coming from the post office.
So.
And it's the counties around the entire state. All the county clerks are talking about getting the same.
Well, and it's fine. But there should be, if there's no postage and it's from out of state, I don't know how that works, but.
Well, we'll ask our clerk to pursue that and find out the.
And I think. And just
the franking process for that.
I think anybody should be able to communicate with their elected officials, you know. But if this was being stuck on done for free, then I'd have a little problem. You know, it could be racist. It could say all black people are bad or something. You know, so we just have. I don't know how this works. That's all. And well, there's no postage on it.
It's our understanding that it has come through U.S. mail. So we'll check into that and give you an answer hopefully by the 19th. Thank you for raising the issue. Any other future agenda items? If not, Supervisor Sobranek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of points to ponder for the adventurous. You do not need a parachute to skydive. You only need a parachute to skydive twice. So if first you don't succeed, well, skydiving is not for you. I move to adjourn.
Moved by Supervisor Sobranek, seconded by Supervisor Meyer. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. We are adjourned.